apparently Treasury.
Good morning, colleagues, members of the audience. It is Wednesday, May 15th, 2013. We're nearly halfway through this month.
Yay.
Welcome to this meeting of the House Committee on Higher Education and Workforce Development. Today we're going to focus on the issue of paying for college, financial aid, where we are, where we hope to move to, all of those issues that we have been touching on them throughout this session. And we're going to start off, so I'm going to open the informational hearing on this subject of financial aid and college affordability. And what we're going to do is, if you will, colleagues, put your minds back a couple of months when we started this session. Back in the good old days, we had a Higher Ed 101 where we're looking at different facets of the higher ed system. We had a hearing on a presentation on OSAC, the Student Access Commission. It was very abbreviated, and it wasn't because Mr. Brew had nothing to tell us, because he definitely did, but we ran out of time. So we're going to return to that as the foundation for this hearing. And welcome Bob Brew, Interim Director of OSAC, coming before us again.
Thank you, Chair Gumbrow, Vice Chair Huffman, Vice Chair Harker, members of the committee. Thank you. For the record again, my name is Bob Brew. I'm the Interim Executive Director for Oregon Student Access Commission. And I guess this is the redux of my presentation from February 18th, I believe it was. Basically, I'm going to try and give you a little bit of an overview of the Oregon Student Access Commission. And if I mistakenly switch and call it OSAC, I hope you'll understand. OSAC's been around since 1959, and our agency is the only state agency solely dedicated to providing students of any age access to higher education goals, whether it's a four-year college, a vocational technical certificate, or anywhere in between. Our agency is located in Eugene and has 25 employees. You'll see that we're administered by a seven-member board of commissions appointed by the governor. Two of our board members are students, our commission members are students, and several others have direct financial aid experience. Our organization structure on this chart is a little unusual because we're in a state of transition. Prior to October 1st, I was the operations manager and shared management duties with our executive director and our director of scholarships and access. When our executive director unexpectedly left in October, we shrank from three managers to two and swapped some duties around so we could cover all of our bases. We'll relook at our structure once the legislative session. So moving to this slide, you can see where we view our role, being that we help students plan and pay for college. And in order to do this, we divide our work into four main areas. I'm sorry. The Oregon Opportunity Grant, the OSAC Scholarship Program, public programs, and Aspire. Many of you know about our work on the Oregon Opportunity Grant. In this biennium, we received and processed more than 400,000 valid applications for federal student aid from Oregon residents and awarded nearly $100 million in opportunity grants to Oregon students. In dollar terms, the Opportunity Grant is by far our largest program and provides direct assistance to students actively attending community colleges, public four-year universities, and private nonprofit universities in Oregon. As you can see on the slide, these are our eligibility criteria for the opportunity grant.
Mr. Chair.
Excuse me. Yes, Representative Bluestein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brew, does financial need parallel federal federal financial need, or do we change that, or do you change that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnant, this is, you may have heard of this, the Shared Financial Responsibility Model, and yes, our need-based awarding criteria is very similar to what the federal feds use, and in fact, we use the free application for federal student aid as our application for the opportunity grant. And this kind of shows how the shared responsibility model works. We first take the average cost of education for either a public two-year or public four-year university, and we use the University of Oregon as kind of our benchmark for the cost of a four-year university. We apply an expected share of student contribution, which is $5,800 a year for community college students and $8,800 for students at public and private or private nonprofit four-year institutions. And that assumes a level of loan burden. Then we use a family share, which is calculated by the federal government. We include then their share that would be expected to be paid by a Pell Grant or various tax credits. For 2013 or 14, the maximum Pell Grant was $5,641, and the maximum tax credit was $2,500. This leads to the unmet need. The Oregon Opportunity Grant is $2,000 for the current year. So if a student had an unmet need calculated on this model greater than $2,000, they would be eligible for an opportunity grant. Unfortunately, there are many more students that are eligible than are able to receive it.
Yes, Representative Greenlee.
The other piece, I remember I was on the higher ed committee when we implemented this sometime in the distant past. But the basic notion was that we would have a four-year commitment then to the student and the family. Is that still a part of the shared responsibility model?
I'm sorry, Chair Dembro, Representative Greenlee. No, that's not part of the current process.
Follow up.
When did that disappear?
Prior to my time, I can research that now.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not sure that was ever anything more than an aspirational goal.
Yeah, I don't think it was.
Chair Greenlee.
It was pretty specific in Kulongoski's original proposal. I mean, I thought that was one of the really innovative things about it. Okay, if you're in, you keep putting your share in, we'll keep putting our share in. Was a very important piece of.
That was certainly part of the rhetoric around it, but I'm not sure it was actually part of the bill. Yeah.
So here's a few statistics on the opportunity grant for 11-12. We don't have the 12-13 information yet. But you can see about 18.6% of the eligible applicants actually were able to use the money or able to access the money. This is a great graphic that I like to use. It looks at the number of applicants or the number of dollars dispersed versus the number of applicants and recipients. I think it's particularly telling when you look at that blue line between 07-09 and 09-11. That was when the recession hit. A lot of folks went back to school, and so our number of applicants went up dramatically.
Excuse me, Bob, if I can interrupt. Were most of those that increased due to community college students? Will you have a slide looking at the increase among the independent colleges, the public universities, the public colleges?
Chair Dembro, I can get that information. I don't have it in my slides. I know that the increase at the community college level was huge. Right. There were increases in the other sectors too, but the increase at the community college was dramatic.
Yeah, thank you.
So I was asked to talk about the Task Force on Higher Education, Student and Institutional Success report, which did talk about how the opportunity grant might incentivize completion. And I'll be talking about that in a little bit more depth. But we do use a key performance measure that talks about persistence rates over 4 years for students at four-year institutions who awarded an opportunity grant versus all applicants. And we can see that on the sample that we measure, and we use 500 random students, The opportunity grants persist at a rate of about 80% versus all applicants at about 44.2%.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brew, but so that doesn't say they finished that fourth year, it's just they got money for 4 years. Are you going to tell us about that?
Yes, Chair Denbrough, Representative Wisnant. So the way the opportunity grant works is that a school will report to us the students that they have registered, and we'll log that information on our computer system. The school doesn't get any money until they verify that student is still enrolled as of that last day to add or drop classes. So at that point, we transfer the money to the school.
I understand.
So we don't disperse money directly to the student, and we also don't disperse money to students who sign up on the first day and then drop out.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, follow up, please.
But my question, they registered for the fourth year, and they got the money, the university got the money, but are you going to give us a slide showing did they graduate with a degree?
I'm not going to do that. As I'll talk about a little bit later, the information currently in the higher ed system is relatively siloed, both for federal privacy reasons, but also for just the nature of our various databases and sharing data arrangements. So once a student goes to college, we don't have a way of tracking them. The only the only interaction we have with them is when they apply for the opportunity grant. We don't know what they're studying. All we know is that the college or the university is reporting that they're still enrolled.
Thanks. Rip Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I know the answer to this question, but Bob, is there any requirement for a student who receives a grant in for a given academic year to demonstrate any sort of academic progress in order to be eligible for the grant in a succeeding year?
Chair Denbrough, Rep. Johnson, yes. So the Pell Grant has requirements that a student must meet, adequate academic progress, and our application is based on their application, it is basically the same criteria. I believe they have to, I'm going to put this out there, and if I'm wrong, I will correct it for the record, but I believe they have to maintain an average of two-thirds of the average class load, or a full-time class load to pass those classes in order to demonstrate that they're making adequate academic progress. And I'm sure that's wrong, and I will correct it.
How is that verified?
That's verified by the federal government.
Oh,
okay. Bob, at some point we'll probably want to come back to that question of how could we get at the actual completion rate, the graduation. I think this is very useful information. The idea that someone can persist for 4 years, I would assume they're going to have a high likelihood of completing if they've been, successful for that long. But it would be useful to figure out a way to get it, the actual graduation. Do you have a sense of what the persistence rate is like at the community colleges? This is at the four-year institutions, both public and private.
Chair Denver, I do have a metric on that, but I didn't bring the slide today.
Okay, so at some point, that would be good to see.
I'll be glad to do that. And I don't want to, the task force report did talk about the need for data and where there were significant gaps in the data availability between the sectors. And if the governor's proposal for a longitudinal database goes forward, I think that would solve a lot of those issues, because we could share that data back and forth between the various sectors.
Thank you. Actually, I have one other question, and that's, we know that students unfortunately find themselves dropping in and out of the opportunity grant program, right? They may be eligible 1 year, the next year they're not. Is this data based on students who have received, they've not dropped out, they've been able to you know, successfully get an opportunity grant each year.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that question?
Yeah, I'm sorry, it wasn't as clear as I wanted. So we have heard that the funding levels are inadequate to guarantee a student, you know, as Rep. Greenlich was asking for, you know, where they could be guaranteed they're going to get it each of the 4 years. They might have it their first year, and then the second year there's not enough, or, you know, their family drops out of eligibility because the threshold's been lowered. They don't have it. Then maybe the next year they do, or maybe they've dropped out somewhere in between. Is there a way? I guess my assumption is that these are students who have received the opportunity grant for all 4 years. Is there a way to look at what's happening to students who lose the opportunity grant?
Chair Denbrough, I don't know at this point. I mean, I think that, again, once they start the university, we don't track them unless they come back and apply again. And if they apply again and are unsuccessful, we don't know if they go ahead then and attend university anyway, or if they give up. And this next slide might be instructive. This is a proposed KPM that we're looking at using, and it kind of shows what happens that, you know, for the when we award grants at the community college level, only about 50.8% of the students actually then follow up, enroll, and get to that point where that grant is awarded to the school. It's higher at OUS institutions and then at nonprofits.
And if I could interrupt, presumably at the privates, they've chosen to go to school out of state. Is that probably why they're not? They applied, but they didn't use it.
There's a variety of reasons. I think that one of them, yes, they maybe have applied and been awarded the grant, but then they decided that they went go to either they'd go to school at a non-eligible university or college, or they decide not to go to college at all. I know that particularly in the community college, a student might apply and see what financial aid they have, and then they would make the decision, given what I've received in financial aid, can I go ahead and go or not?
Go to school, period.
Yeah, I mean, the folks that get the opportunity grant have pretty low incomes, so it's definitely competing for other household expenses.
Yes, Rep. Wilson.
Mr. Brood, so 60% of the funds that that we approve for opportunity grants were used. What happens to that other 40%? Is that, do you build that up in the bank, or does that go back to the general fund, or how is?
I'm sorry, Chair Denbrough, Rep. Wilson. What happens is then that we. All of the money is dispersed. It's just that if you could imagine that there's the people at the front of the line get awarded first. If they end up not using that or not choosing to go to school in Oregon or whatnot, then the next people in line get the money. So it all gets dispersed to students. It's just a matter of...
That doesn't make sense, Mr. Chair. So your chart says awarded versus used. So there's a
I'm going to use this I won't use an example. So we are for the current biennium we've requested $115 million to be awarded in opportunity grants. We will probably award $150 million, knowing that the number of dollars that are actually picked up and used will be much less. Much the way an airline might oversell seats, knowing that not everyone who gets a ticket will show up to fly. And that's based on, we're very conservative in the awards that we give, but we do know that the statistics have borne out over many, many years how many are actually picked up and used.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Rep. Green.
You don't take all the applications and then pick out which ones to award, as I remember. You do it as they apply, so that you actually, it's just people who've applied later are waiting in line because you give the first awards to people.
Yes.
Earlier.
Chair Denbrough, Representative Granlich, that's correct. So we had an application deadline this year of February 1st. For lack of a better term, we ran out of money on about midway through January 31st. And so those were our first tier. Those students were guaranteed an opportunity grant. As we refine the number of students who actually pick those up, then we will, as we determine that money is still available, we'll award those remaining students as far as we can up till the February 1st deadline.
And what was the final proportion of the people who qualified that actually got a grant?
18.6%, yes.
And Bob, in the past, you've also held on to some of the money for students who start midway through the year. Is that right? And then that's, you stop doing that? Or what is the practice as far as that goes?
So thank you, Chair Denbrough. Yes, we do, at one point we did that. We don't do that any longer. Just the number of students, the need outweighs the available funds by so much. So these are some of the other public programs that we administer. The Chafee Education Trading Grant, that's for former foster youth, deceased and disabled public safety officers. This is for children of deceased and disabled public safety officers, and so on. Quite a variety of programs that we administer. If there are no questions, I'll keep moving.
Actually, I do, Mr. Chair.
I'm sure you want to know about the barber and hairdresser grant.
I knew it. That was right where I was. Bob, can you go down the list and tell us where these monies come from? I see federal and I see state, but
sure.
Is this work that you do with the education subcommittee, and this is part of your financial ask every biennium to fund these different state categories, or how does that money get plugged into your budget?
Chair Denbrough, Representative Huffman. Yes, so for example, the deceased or disabled public safety officers, I believe this is a subset of our Oregon Opportunity Grant recipients. It's a fairly small dollar amount. The Oregon Student Child Care Grant, this is a general fund allocation. The Jobs Plus Individual Education Account, this is money that's we work in conjunction with the Department of Human Services on that one. The Oregon Youth Conservation Corps, I believe it might be employment, but I'd have to go back and check. And the Barber and Hairdressers Grant, this is, for lack of a better term, an endowment that goes back many, many years associated with, I believe that at one point we overcharged for licensing for, the state overcharged for licensing for several years. The overcharged amount was put into an endowment, and the corpus is retained, but the interest is dispersed.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, for Huffman.
And Bob, I may have been a little harsh on you back in February, and you were probably feeling lucky that you only had about 10 minutes that day in the hearing based on the line of questioning. But a few things. Some of the work that I'm doing in the building, particularly with capital construction right now, the OUS was directed, they always come up with their list of priorities for capital construction projects. And they have traditionally had a matrix that they look at, leverage dollars, individual campus need, you know. Last year, after they developed that list, as they usually have, the governor's office reached out and said, okay, I want you to redo that list based on 40-40-20. And so Jay Kenton and others had to re-evaluate the list, and most of the projects changed. Some of the projects totally fell off the list for the ask for this session, or this session for next biennium. Has the governor's office done anything with you and OSAC in that regard as far as 40-40-20 and how the opportunity grant funds are being invested in students and how it aligns? And in February, you mentioned that you don't have particularly a tracking mechanism to be able to tell us that a specific opportunity grant dollar is ending in a completed degree. Has the governor's office had conversations with you about tracking and how we're making sure that the opportunity grant is meeting state goals now?
Yes. Chair Denbrough, Representative Huffman. Yes, the Chief Education Officer, Dr. Rudy Crewe, has directed the OUS Chancellor to reconvene task force on I'm not going to get the name right, so I'm not even going to try. He's asked to reconvene a task force that was originally came up with the shared responsibility model to look specifically at, among other things, how do we ensure that the dollars we invest in the Oregon Opportunity Grant are incentivizing completions. A recent article out of the University of Florida said that in order to really make a difference in incentivizing completions for these folks that are really low-income folks, the need-based grant needs to be about 70% of the cost of education, because otherwise it's just competing against rent and car repairs and everything else for that household dollar. And when we look at the opportunity grant at about $2,000, it represents somewhere around 7% of the cost of full cost of a 1 year of a 4 year university education. So I'm estimating that the link will be there just based on our KPMs, but it might not be as strong as we'd like it to be.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Some comments, follow-up. I visited with Representative Comp on this, and I would appreciate if this committee would reinforce basically what Bob is saying, and maybe in the form of a budget note or something that puts legislative intent. I understand that most of us would say that the opportunity grant is underfunded based on the need that's out there, but it's still a lot of money, and it needs to be accounted for based on statutory goals. And I would just feel a lot more comfortable if we were tracking those dollars to degree completion. Another thing, too, aside from opportunity grant, and it involves OSAC, but it involves the legislature. It's a much broader subject, and Joe and I just had a meeting a couple of days ago, and yet again, the legislature every session works on projects where we direct higher education, community colleges, and OUS to provide free college to a subset of potential students, whether they be veterans dependents, whether they be foster kids, whatever that situation is. At some point, and I'm trying to educate people because I'm on enough different committees that I follow the money, or I follow the lack of money, and what we're doing, we sit on this committee and talk about OUS, community colleges, you have to keep tuition increases down. You can't increase tuition by more than 5% or whatever. But we don't put adequate state funding into the institutions. So the only few areas that institutions can get additional needed revenue is from student fees, increased tuition, and out-of-state tuition. So more students paying out-of-state tuition. So every time the legislature wants to feel like this benefactor, you know, where we direct OUS to provide free education to somebody, my kids end up paying for those free students through increased tuitions and fees and whatnot. And at some point, we have to figure out that that's really who's paying for these asks that we put on OUS. OUS, community colleges, is always very, very kind and willing to work with us because they don't want to tell the legislature no. But the bottom line is, somebody has to pay for that free education. And I should probably shut up there, Mr. Chair. Would that be a good place for me to get off my soapbox, step down, and agree?
I think we hear what you've said, and I think it demonstrates that you have been listening to the challenges that we face. I think we all do see that, and you know, part of the challenge that we face is structural. I've mentioned this before. You know, we decry silos out there among the agencies and et cetera, but we in the legislature also have our own silos, and you know, one of the main ones is between the policy committees and the ways and means, and the two don't always, you know, work together. But that is. You know, what you're talking about is a real challenge. I know that we have tried in the past with some of those programs that you just referenced, like the former foster youth, to keep the burden down to the very minimum on the institutions by making it so that they, you know, the bulk of the of support that will come to them will come from the Pell Grant and the Opportunity Grant, et cetera. And, you know, there's a requirement that the former foster youth have to have applied for an opportunity grant, you know, just to keep the burden as low as possible on the universities. But you do definitely raise some good points. I will say I am very impressed with the number that that Bob gave us about the persistence rate among the four-year institutions. I think, you know, if the general population is at 44%, and opportunity grant students are at 80%. I mean, that says something, I think. So that gives me a certain amount of confidence. But those larger questions of, so maybe the opportunity grant needs to be bigger in order to have an even, you know, greater effect. Well, then, unless the amount that we give the program increases, then we have to think about, would it be better for us to lower the number of people who are getting the opportunity grant and give a guarantee to them that they will be able to have it for 4 years and it'll be, you know, at a more substantial level? That's a tough conversation to have. I think one of the positive things, you know, I hope that we'll see in the newly configured Higher Education Coordinating Commission is, you know, having an entity that is working with community colleges, universities, and OSAC together, you know, they can make those tough decisions and really have the kind of comprehensive conversations that are needed.
Yeah. Just to finish that one thought, because you were talking about the disconnect sometimes, I don't think that's the word to use, but there's a disconnect sometimes between policy and ways and means. And, you know, I would like to ask, put on the record asking future speakers to consider this. And when bills are assigned to committees, we have committees making decisions on bills that affect higher ed's budget, and not a single member of the committee has anything to do with ways and means, or higher ed. So those committee members have never had to deal with OUS budgets, community college budgets, and they're wanting to grant free education to a subset of students based on a category that is largely dealt with in veterans or human services or whatever. And I would like to see all of those higher ed related bills, before they go anywhere, be referred to the committee that actually deals with the subject of higher ed, and instead of veterans or somebody else sending a bill down to ways and means, or, you know, it's
yeah,
just
no, it's right.
So that we can get that connection back.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah. And of course, it gets worse as the session nears its end.
Right. Yeah. Mr. Chair, I appreciate those comments. And as one person that's 59 votes away from speaker, I will take that under advisement.
You sure you're only 59?
You would love yourself.
Speaker. Hey.
Speaker. Wow, that's great.
You're always a speaker of the truth. we appreciate that.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
I have a question for you in terms of the number of recipients in each of these categories. Is there a ceiling on this? Things like disabled public safety officer, that fluctuates, but things like, for instance, the child care one, is there a maximum level that you can award, or does it just float?
Chair Denver, Representative Gorsuch, it floats based on the amount available for disbursement. So
okay. So each category gets a certain amount of money.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I recognize that that I'm over my time, so I'd like to continue and
please
and,
yes.
Another important thing that OSAC does, we are a scholarship administrator. We administer over 450 funds. We're unique in the nation that we administer this many scholarships for the Oregon Community Foundation, the Ford Family Foundation, and many private donors across the state. We give away $16 million annually, and this program is completely self-supporting through administrative fees. We think it's a great partnership with the Opportunity Grant, and we build some great relationships with students. So this shows the number of scholarships and the number of dollars distributed since 1991-92, and you can definitely see the increase in the program. We work very very closely with our partners to continue growing the program, continuing getting money to students. And these scholarships are for a variety of students. Some are need-based, some are merit-based, some are was your dad a Teamster? Variety of different criteria. We try and have something for everybody, and there's at least one scholarship per county in the state, so we try and reach everybody. The students apply for these scholarships via our online application, via our website, which is new this year and continuing in development. The fourth leg of our stool is our Aspire program. This is in the governor's recommended budget for an increase this year. The Aspire program is a very unique program that has a site administrator in each school that works with children to talk about, high school students primarily, to talk about their options for post-high school and so on. So primarily we're in high schools. We also have, and those are one-on-one mentoring programs. We also have programs in middle schools. We have three pilot programs in community colleges, and we do have some programs that are based out of community-based organizations. Right now we have 138 sites, 1,500 plus volunteer mentors, and we hope to, if the governor's recommendation is approved, we hope to have 295 sites by the end of 2013-15, one in every school district in Oregon.
I didn't even have to look over there. I knew Rep. Johnson had his hand up. Yes, speak to this program, Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bob, with the increased recommendation from the governor, what will those resources go towards? Will it be at OSAC's level? Will it be at the local level, at the schools? Where will that money be spent?
Chair Denver, Representative Johnson. So the model that Aspire is based on is, if you can imagine, concentric circles. Mm-hmm. So we have a director that's at OSAC, and the director administers several regional coordinators that take an area of the state, and those are the only paid staff by the state. Those regional coordinators work with
what we call site coordinators that are at each of the schools or community-based organizations. And what they do is they coordinate volunteers at that school to provide the mentoring. So we provide some statewide oversight. We provide the training materials and so on. At some schools, many schools have a counselor or a librarian or something that they assign to be the site coordinator, and we provide them the materials. The partnership works like that. We do have a small pool of stipends that we give to some schools so that they can pay a teacher or something along the lines of they would pay a coach, mm-hmm. a small stipend to take on these extra duties to be that site coordinator. But then all of the direct service is provided by these volunteer mentors. So it's a really cost-effective program.
And then just a quick follow-up then. So is it true then that the regional coordinators make sure that whoever it is that's at the local school district level in each high school, if you will, know what they're actually referring to, they know the process and so forth, so that they're equipped and skilled in what they're communicating to the prospective post-secondary students?
Yes, sir. We do an extensive training. It's ongoing training, and our site, our regional coordinators visit each of those site coordinators constantly throughout the year to make sure that what they're teaching and distributing is accurate.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
This slide shows the current Aspire sites across the state. And this is just a few statistics of some of our schools that had a fairly low college-going rates before Aspire and some of the changes that we've seen since the Aspire has come on board. And this is an overview of where we're going over the next year. We've asked to create some stable funding for Aspire to increase the number of Aspire sites and increase our scholarship pool from, this says 430, but it's actually 450. We want to get to 500 by the end of the biennium. And I thank you. If there's any further questions.
Yes, Rep. Gillian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On those, you've got somebody waiting. I don't want them. Are students allowed or are encouraged to go straight to you for those applications? Because I would think that would be a great advantage to our students with that scholarship fund. They don't have to start with the original fund or process, do they?
Oh, Chair Denver, Representative Gillian. No, in fact, that's the real advantage that we have is we have one website that they go online. They can apply for as many scholarships as they qualify for on that one application.
Terrific. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Brewer, your last slide, where you're headed, I think I support everything, opportunity grants, that's Aspire program, all these. What you've shown me is a great outcome from Aspire. You haven't shown me, and when my colleague becomes speaker, he may ask you to come back with some statistics, as Representative Huffman said, on how many people are completing. You're briefing me, your mission is to get children or young people in college. But that's not our mission. Our mission is to graduate them and make them good citizens and productive citizens. So I really hope that you'd work on giving us more data on outcomes from these students. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you very much, Bob.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to call up, we have a few people from OUS schools. Philip Rogers, Kate Peterson, and Dave McDonald. Would you come forward?
Good morning.
Hello. Welcome.
Chair Denbrough and committee members. For the record, I'm Kate Peterson, Assistant Provost for Enrollment Management at Oregon State University. Today we have a panel of three OUS colleagues, and I will begin by sharing some information regarding the Oregon University system and the various colleagues that our efforts are coordinated through OUS by Joe Holliday, who's also here today. In the last year, OUS has focused on the development of system-wide policies and practices that are aimed at reducing student reliance on student loans. Our board's Academic Strategies Committee has endorsed a multi-pronged approach, which includes early warning systems at each campus to intervene with financially at-risk students, system-wide adoption of the Federal Financial Aid Shopping Sheet, expanded financial literacy efforts, and several other components. We will also be holding a statewide symposium on student loan debt management and affordability on October 23rd at Portland State University, and Oregon policy and educational leaders will be invited to this event. So I'm going to now begin with some best practices and ongoing efforts that are taking place at each of our institutions. And so at Oregon State University, we had a concern about the level and the messaging, the level of attention, the messaging that is being propagated regarding the role of student loans and rising student loan debt. Many of these articles are cautioning families of the horrors of student loans. And you see these kinds of articles or programs pretty much daily at this point. A concern that I have is in working with students and their families, we now have families seeing student loans as a bad option. And many of our highest risk students are not even considering going to college because they are afraid of the student loan programs. They have a misunderstanding of the actual cost of attending college, and they have heard a lot of the media hype about the dangers of student loans. So we have undertaken a student loan debt project with the desired outcome of busting some of these myths by providing realistic data-based information about the OSU student population. This project seeks to provide OSU-specific information on the positive role of student loans, including the return on investment based on average starting salaries of our students and what that would relate to in terms of monthly loan repayments. We are also presenting evidence to our colleagues on campus that supports the need for increased grant and scholarship aid, which is necessary to meet our enrollment goals and to meet our college completion targets. So as OSU is wrapping up their fundraising campaign and beginning to set priorities for the next phase of our campaign, we are presenting evidence that shows the positive impact of gift aid and scholarships, so that continues to be one of the priorities for our fundraisers. We're also collaborating with academic colleges in the development of consumer information for students and their families on how to pay for college, and also the lifelong value of higher education. The second program that I want to make you aware of is the Bridge to Success program. This was modeled after the Oregon Opportunity Grant Shared Responsibility model in that it leverages federal and state aid and institutional aid in order to cover with gift aid tuition and fees for students who are Pell Grant and Oregon Opportunity Grant eligible. And then in addition, about 49% of the students on the Bridge to Success program also have their books and supplies covered with gift aid. The award is renewed for up to 4 years as long as the students continue to make satisfactory academic progress toward their degree. A recent study shows that the Bridge to Success students persist at 11.3% higher rate than those with lesser gift aid. The impact on the Bridge to Success program is disproportionately high for underrepresented groups, including Oregon students of color. Now, the study has demonstrated the importance of gift aid and the role that it plays in meeting our enrollment goals, and we believe it is a wise investment on the part of the state. Although Bridge students still rely on some loans to pay the remaining educational costs, they graduate with an average of $4,000 less student loan debt, which reduces their monthly payments by approximately $40. Next, we will hear from my colleague to my right, Dave McDonald, Associate Provost from Western Oregon University.
Good morning, Chair Denbrough, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dave McDonald. I am the Associate Provost at Western Oregon University. A couple points to follow up on comments Mr. Brew made earlier to this committee. The Oregon Opportunity Grant for us is an essential form of financial aid and an essential part of our efforts to have affordability attained for our students. In the last 6 years, the number of students who received a Pell Grant, which is linked to the Opportunity Grant, grew from 43% to 57%. However, because of the limitations in the dollars available to the Opportunity Grant, the growth in that grant only went from 38% to 41%. In reality, the two should be linked lockstep, so as we have an increase in population of Pell Grant recipients, the growth in Opportunity Grant recipients should be of equal amount. Obviously, we have a disconnect in terms of available funds that support the students. One of the questions asked of Mr. Brew was, is there a linkage between the Opportunity Grant and actual outcome being graduation? At Western Oregon University, there is indeed such a linkage. Students who receive the Opportunity Grant have graduated at about 10 percentage point higher rate than their peers who did not receive an Opportunity Grant. For us, there's a very clear relationship between that grant and success leading to degree completion. When we look at affordability, quite frankly, the conversation has to be a two-way conversation, and I think Chair Huffman started to get to that when he was on his very, very appealing soapbox earlier in the morning. For us, affordability starts with what your colleagues do in the Ways and Means process. As they cut our budget, and for Western, our budget has dropped by 30% over the last 6 years, we have no other recourse but to look to other funding sources, which unfortunately generally start with tuition and fees for students. If there were greater funding for us, we'd have lesser need to increase our tuition, and the whole pressure on our students would be much, much lower. To contextualize it, we kind of break affordability into four categories in the student budget. Tuition and fees. So for Western Oregon, tuition and fees accounted for about 37% of the total student budget last year. Room and board, that accounts for about 42% of the budget the students pay to go to college. Books and supplies, about 7.5%. And transportation and personal. The cell phone, whether they have the iPhone, whether they have the whatever the latest greatest is, all those personal items that the student chooses, the transportation to and from, that's about 14%. So put in context, the tuition that we control at the university is roughly a little bit more than a third of the total budget the student and their family will pay to go to college. Looking at each of those four things, I want to speak briefly to things that the university is doing to address each of them, because they're all important. I testified in front of this committee about a month ago on our tuition promise / tuition choice program, so I won't rehash that one. Other than to say our latest data shows that about half of the students are choosing the promise and the other half the choice because of different financial situations. The save now, save later option is appealing to different students, and we find that ratio very successful. It means that students and families are really seeing value in having an opportunity. For room and board, we started a new program that's really in its first iteration. I have no data other than to say we're making the awards, but we looked at those students who were receiving the Pell Grant, who are from Oregon, and we offered them the opportunity to receive a reduction in their room and board to help make college affordable. So we have offered a $600 reduction in room and board to those Pell Grant students from Oregon. Obviously, they all say yes to that opportunity as a way to try to drop the cost down. Now, some of it is, as Representative Huffman said, a paying or robbing Peter to pay Paul. because our costs of the housing haven't changed. We're simply moving the expenses around a little bit to make them a little more affordable for a group of students. Books and supplies, we're really proud of the fact that we have a full-scale textbook and materials rental program that impacts and benefits every student. So that in our, if you think about Redbox as a model compared to buying the video, that is very analogous to what we do on our campus. A majority of our textbooks and we have calculators are rented to students at about a third the price of what it would cost for them to buy the book. The rental program, since its inception 2 years ago, has saved about $1 million to our students. Now, the challenge for my colleagues in putting such a program together is there's a huge upfront cost to this. So it's taken us 2 years to realize $1 million in savings. The initial program cost us $1 million to start. And we were fortunate to get a federal grant to do that. Otherwise, we could not have done that on our own. It is a nice way of doing it. And then we look at transportation and personal expenses. How many pizzas does a student choose to buy? How many toppings in those pizza? Things like that. We just reached a partnership with Mass Credit Union here in Salem to create a major initiative around financial literacy. So beginning this fall, every one of our freshmen in the residence halls and in our first-year experience will actually undergo training in terms of making wise financial decisions. How to use the dollars they have, how to use the loan money. And I agree with my colleague, loans are not the problem. They're actually part of the solution for many of our students. But how to use them intelligently so that they don't overextend what they don't need to have. And that process is part of what we're trying to do with our students to help them become not only good graduates, but successful in their lives in terms of financial management into their 30s, their 40s, and such. Two other ways in which we're trying to make college affordable is looking at time to degree. The less time a student's enrolled, the less time they have to incur debt, the less their overall debt, the sooner they're actually employed in paying off those debts. So we have employed a brand new student success specialist, new software that's really aimed at proactively reaching students and saying, we need you to take more courses, the decision you're making now has some impacts, and trying to be very proactive in our ability to work with our students around making sure they take the right courses the right way and the right timing to graduate as soon as possible. This being a new program, we don't have outcome data on it yet, but certainly the national literature and research shows that this is a very wise move on our part. And finally, this financial literacy piece, again, helping students make wise choices. There's only so much we can do as a university. I think that Western is an example. You'll hear from my other colleagues of other things that they're doing. All of us are deeply concerned about this. We're deeply concerned about the fact that both affordability from a reality and a perception is reaching a point in which we're leaving students behind. Leaving students and all of our communities behind from gaining the benefits of a college degree. And so we look forward to working with you. From a really specific standpoint, I have my colleague here from Portland State University, Philip Rogers, who is the Director of Student Financial Aid and Scholarships, to talk about what they're doing at Portland State.
Thank you. Good morning.
Welcome.
Chair Jimbrough and committee members, good morning. My name is Philip Rogers. I am the Director of Student Financial Aid and Scholarships here at Portland State University. I just want to take a few minutes to piggyback on a few things that my colleagues have said. One, at Portland State, we're working on what's called road mapping to help our students. The average student actually takes about five and a half years to 6 years to graduate at Portland State University. And we're working on developing what's called road mapping, which will help the students actually see how they can graduate from Portland State in 4 years. As you can tell, the longer the student stays in school, the more debt they incur. So we're working to with this new program that we have to help students understand if you stay the course and you take a certain amount of credit hours, then you will actually graduate in 4 years. Other things that we're doing to increase transparency is we have what's called the financial aid report card. And what we do is we provide students on a quarterly basis with an actual report card, especially our housing students, to actually show this is how much it's going to cost you in housing, financial aid, in housing and your education, and this is how much you have in financial aid. And then we meet with them individually. The bursar's office, student accounts, meets with them to actually develop a payment plan system to help the students to pay for their education. So it helps them to be transparent in understanding exactly how much it's going to cost the students per year. In addition to that, we have the financial aid shopping sheet that was developed by the Department of Education. We've had it modified to actually help students before they even decide to come to Portland State or any other school, how much will it cost to actually attend Portland State University, as well as how much you'll receive in financial aid. And we've incorporated the actual award letter so the students actually see exactly how much in financial aid they'll receive. So it helps with the transparency for parents and students to understand exactly how much it's going to cost to come to Portland State and exactly what could be your out-of-pocket expenses. The final thing is we have faculty, staff who have identified students who, through maybe death in the family, child being born, and other extenuating circumstances, are very close to graduating, however, have dropped out. They're very close, and we created what's called the Last Mile Program. And the Last Mile Program helps those students who are right there at the gate to graduating that are not able to do so based upon financial circumstances. So we've actually, through the president's office, developed a pot of resources to help those students to get across that threshold. The program is in its second year. So far, we've had approximately 55 students to actually graduate who otherwise would not have graduated. So I don't have the direct specifics in terms of statistics in terms of how it is, but that past year we had 55 students. So once again, we're trying to work with transparency so family students can understand exactly how much it costs to come to Portland State University as well as any other institution in the OUS system. Thank you.
Thank you. That's very exciting. I wonder if could you get us a copy of one of those, I forget what you called it, you know, the update letters, the quarterly letters that goes out to people, the report card.
Yes, I have them here.
Yeah, that would be great.
Okay. Yes.
Very, very impressive series of programs. Vice Chair Harker.
Thank you. The program that you have that enables students to rent textbooks, calculators, etc. I think you said you got a $2 million grant, and it's already saving students $1 million in 2 years. Is that right?
Chair Dembro, Vice Chair Harker, it's a $1 million starting grant, and it has saved students $1 million to date. So it's already paid for itself. It was some of the best federal dollars we could have gotten.
Does it appear at this point in time to be a sustainable model? The books and calculators, et cetera, will have to be replaced. Of course, they'll have a certain lifespan. How does this look? What do your forecasts show?
Absolutely. Representative Harker, the program was designed to be sustainable beyond the period of the grant, and it is my belief that indeed it will be sustainable and slightly expandable as we move forward. It is a very promising program for us. It's very exciting, and it's one that is benefiting all of our students across all economic backgrounds.
Please.
We've talked a fair amount about the cost of textbooks in here, as you all well know. Subject matters evolves. There have to be some limitations on how broadly this could be applied, but does it seem to you to be something that could be applied to core curriculum or a subset of the courses across multiple institutions? And has Portland State looked at implementing something like this? Maybe you already have it and I'm not aware of it.
Oh, we do not have that yet.
Okay.
There, as you noted, Representative Harford, there are limitations. Paperback books, for instance, do not lend themselves for repeated rentals. The continued proliferation of digital textbook materials, especially in mathematics and such, also limits the applicability because those typically have a time duration on which the student can access that material online. Our faculty have also taken other steps to try to cut costs, what we call custom textbooks, where they will work with a publisher to, instead of having a 400-page textbook, only print the chapters that they're going to use, reducing the cost down. Those aren't easily available for rental because, again, the changing nature. And the final challenge is that the textbook publishers themselves are an active player and have an incentive to try to maintain the status quo, and that is buy, and buy more. So they tend to try to push new editions of books out more rapidly, making older editions more obsolete.
Yes, thank you for that. And I will, just if I could just piggyback on that, that one of the things that's been talked about in the task force on textbook affordability has been a state bonding program that would provide the upfront costs, the upfront money to then allow students to rent. And I know that some of the K-12 districts have been using their bond money to purchase textbooks for their students, and it wouldn't be a big shift for us to look at a program like that for the state.
Mm-hmm. No, thank you. I was actually pointing that Rep. Gallegos down there had his hand up outside your peripheral vision.
Okay, Gallegos and then Wisdom, please. Before you start, say, Larry, we're probably not going to be able to get to you, and I apologize for that.
We have a chance later.
We certainly will, and perhaps we can. We'll talk about rescheduling. There may be some other issues related to independent colleges and universities that we might want you to speak to as well. Great. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair Dumbrow. I'm curious about it is a tremendous thing to sort of balance and juggle all of the interests, I think, in the textbook course development process. I'm also thinking about this from the faculty perspective, that getting books published is seen as an important part of faculty development scholarship. And so getting those editions redone all the time also. So it seems to me that there needs to be a discussion also within the institutions with regard to tenure and promotion and so on in terms of the faculty credit and so on. So it's not just the cost of the books, but also that whole process that we reward faculty for. The other part of it is that despite then the cost of the books and the need for new editions, I'm aware that knowledge is just happening so fast, and that a student, particularly in technical kinds of areas, entering at their freshman year, the whole field changes by the time they're seniors, and so the need for textbooks is critical in some of those areas. So, I appreciate that it's a very fine balance that needs to be achieved, and I think your efforts to cut down on those costs is really laudable. But again, like I said, I think it's an amazingly interesting dance to have and then you've got the interests of the bookstores themselves on campuses as well. I did have another question, though, that is sort of unrelated, but it has to do probably with Mr. Brew, rather, but I'd be interested in the outcome data, but also the ethnic breakdown and part of the socio-demographic breakdown in terms of the outcome data.
Thank you.
So once we get there, that'll be very interesting to see. Thank you.
Real quick.
Yes,
Great news. This is good news for legislature and students. I want to be sure that Aspire people are getting this information and using that. So I hope you're doing an interface with them in some way. Provost McDonald, your financial literacy thing is also good news. I've tried unsuccessfully to get that in high school. We did have the Eastern Promise people say they're doing it in the ninth grade. They're doing it in the ninth grade and giving college credit for the course at Eastern. So they talk about return on investment and how you get that big dodge with another example. So, but good news. Thank you.
Rick Borsett.
One thing that is going on at Portland State, though, whereas the bookstore is not doing it, there is the bookstore down the street that is very much tied to the university. in that they collect, they buy back all of these books for various classes. And so when you go into that bookstore, it's as if you're in the university bookstore, and the books are much cheaper. I mean, that's another model that's out there. But it's definitely, as far as I know, unless you know different, I believe it's completely disconnected from the university itself.
It is.
Okay.
Rep. Dilliam, last word.
Just to join you in saying I'm very sorry that we didn't get to Larry Large. Yeah. I really appreciate this information, and I look forward to him coming back.
Yes, yes, as do I. I'm sorry.
This is the public side is so important, but also our private institutions. And here you have a guy who, if he wasn't president, vice president, or acting president, he manipulated the presidents of every independent college. And I look forward to him coming back.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for that, Rep. Dilliam. Thank you all for coming. It's really good to hear about these efforts. They're desperately needed. But, Mr. McDonald, to your point, all of the innovations that you all are doing do not absolve us of the responsibility to adequately fund higher education in this state. We're committed to that.
Thank you.
Okay, so with that, I'm going to close this informational session. Colleagues, we're not meeting on Friday. Next week, we're meeting just Monday and Wednesday, and we will be meeting at 8:30 on those days.
Okay. Wait, what?
All right, with that, we're adjourned.